we're gonna do my favorite thing. Oh, how I love to go camping. Going camping feels good. Camping here in the woods. Camping makes me sing. Oh, how I love to go camping.
So who loves to go camping? What kind of camping do you like and why? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this 4th of July weekend, many of us are camping. Millions of Americans are pitching a tent at their favorite campground. We will talk this hour about how this came to be, how America fell in love with camping. It was once a necessary tool for survival, but now it is a recreational activity, a sometimes a quirky recreational activity that an estimated 50 million Americans now participate in every year. What is the appeal of camping? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest, Dan White, a travel writer as well as the contributing editor of the Catamaran Literary Reader. He is author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. And he joins us from the West Coast, so it's extra early. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
So are you in love with camping?
You know, I love it, and as I mentioned early on in the book, I love it, and I sometimes wrestle with conflicting feelings of it. I sometimes love it and hate it at the same time. I feel like when I go out there, I have to sort of learn to embrace the chaos, to embrace the unexpected. Because one thing that appeals to me so much about camping, but also sometimes infuriates me, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners would agree, is that things can really go wildly off the rails, and I really have to have a sense of humor about it and kind of expect the unexpected.
Well, maybe we'll get into some of those stories of it going wildly off the rails. It is really a sort of an odd thing. We leave behind all the comforts and pleasures of home. We hoof it outdoors. We're subject to weather, to bugs, to animals, and many other dangers. With that in mind, how do you explain the popularity of camping?
Well, I can explain the popularity of camping, the popularity based on just how much things have changed in America. We had to reach a certain point of industrialization and people getting so stressed out by the pace of their lives. So the wilderness looked like something other than the source of terror, to something that we had to flee from. So we started looking at it and reconsidering our old views, because the people, the founding fathers of America, if you had said, "I'm going camping for the weekend," they would have thought you're insane, because there was this very adversarial relationship with the woods. It was considered evil. It was considered good only for practical reasons, to be chopped down, turned into agricultural land. And so there had to be so many social changes for the whole idea to even start making sense. And what I think is really interesting when I was studying the history of camping is there were people who were kind of, they were weirdos for their time, but they were going out there and they were experimenting with recreational camping before there was a context for it. But, and people would see them and they have no idea what they were doing. They think they were spies. They think they were crazy. So for this to become a thing, for it to become a fad and then really just take over as part of American culture, we had to have these pretty radical changes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, on how you point out that optional or recreational camping is a relatively recent development. So what did we first, when did we first start to see the emergence of camping for fun?
Well, you had people who were kind of messing around with that very early on. William Byrd of Westover, he was out on a survival trip, and this was in the 1700s, amazingly enough. This is more of a survival expedition where he was trying to fix this disputed border. And he was out there for hundreds of miles with a group of men. But there was one night where he could have stayed in lodging, and he chose to stay outdoors anyhow, and he described how wonderful it was and sleeping under the stars and how new and how radical it seemed to him. It was this really kind of cheeky, kind of rebellious gesture to sleep outside when he didn't have to. And there was another fellow in the early 1800s named Estwick Evans, and he was just really remarkable, kind of crazy. He lit out from New Hampshire in the depths of the winter in February of 1818 and decided to go on a big, long camping trip for reasons other than survival, just to see America, to get in touch with himself. And he's the one who people would see him camping with his two dogs and his guns and his hatchets, and they thought he was out of his mind. But he made it all the way to the Western territories and back. You know, for camping to really take off, it's more like the mid-19th century where America starts to get a bit more built up and people started experimenting with going out to the Adirondacks and these wildernesses. But the thing about it is the first Americans who went recreational camping in the late 19th century, there were these baby steps because they were too terrified to go out there by themselves. All these things we take for granted today, like going out there on your own, making your own campfire, doing it for yourself, they outsourced all that. They had these paid, extremely skilled wilderness guides who would go out there, and they were like bodyguards where they would do everything for them. They would build the campfire. They would play the harmonica. And these early campers didn't even have to bring tents because you had certain guides who would just go out there and hack down a big chunk of forest, and they would strip the trees. They would strip the bark. They'd make a one-use, reasonably rainproof shanty for these well-off campers to sleep in, and then just let the thing kind of rot. They would sort of abandon it afterwards. So it's just a very different way of thinking. But one thing I noticed is that we have this fear of the wilderness that originated in Puritan times, and at first we didn't really get rid of it. It was almost like we were counteracting it with these baby steps, just going out there gradually with people to protect us and, you know.
Well, it's been a very long time since I have camped. I was a Girl Scout, so I went Girl Scout camping, and I did some camping of all things, like at, you know, bluegrass festivals when I was in college.
Festival camping, yes, of course.
What did you call it?
I call that festival camping, where you wake up and people are playing music, and people are playing music all night long.
Yeah, and I've gone to some state parks and just with some friends and had a little. But it has been, I swear, it's been 30 years probably, and I'm going to try it again. I am going to try it again. But the thing I loved the most about camping, you mentioned the stars. That's what I loved the most. What is it about being under the stars?
You know, it's amazing where that moment where inevitably people have to get up, you know, halfway through the night and you go outside the tent, just how close on they look and just how bright, and it looks like they're just hanging so low. And I think one of the things that is so interesting about that is very often if you live in a city or even in, you know, kind of a suburb, I live in Santa Cruz, California, and even there it's fairly rural, but there are a lot of lights. And there's a lot of light pollution. So when you get reasonably far out, especially in a national park that tends to be, they tend to be pretty far away from cities, everything just looks so brilliant and bright. And it's just really intoxicating because we're just not used to seeing something that people generate for the earliest Americans almost took for granted. Just the heavens laid out before us. I was climbing Mount Whitney for one scene in the book, and I had to climb, I started climbing it at 3:30 in the morning with a headlamp. And at one point, I was about a third up the way up a flank of the mountain, and I just lay down and turned my headlamp off, and I could see the whole Milky Way. Wow. Spread out before me, and I could see the outline of the mountains, and it was just the most amazing thing. I lay there in the dirt for about 15 minutes just watching the heavens seem to swirl around me. It's such a powerful thing because it's always there, but we are kind of cut out from it. We either don't notice it or the light pollution sort of blocks it.
Right.
Like the scrim is kind of lifted from us when we go camping. And so I feel like it's just one way in which camping exposes us to the immediacy of life, like almost no other experience I can think of. I think that's one reason why people keep going back to it, also because the simplicity and the ritual, like now we're going to have the s'mores, now we're going to do the campfire. There's something about the comfort of simplicity and the repetition and also the removal from the regular strains of life that can really make it intoxicating.
Yeah, and I was going to say, the other thing I love and miss about camping is that campfire. Just the campfire itself was really cool and hot. But the s'mores. I mean, you know, that is something. You're doing the roasting, eating outside, and roasting that marshmallow. Where did that s'mores tradition get its start anyway?
Well, the Girl Scouts, we can credit the Girl Scouts of America. 1927, the Girl Scouts of America introduced the first recipe for s'mores. I've done some research into it, and I can't exactly pinpoint if they're the ones who invented it for sure or if they're the popularizers of it. But basically, because people around the same time had been combining chocolate and graham crackers and marshmallows, but I think the Girl Scouts were among the first to apply heat. That was one of the great innovations. You know, and what is really funny for me about the s'more is I think it's kind of a great rescue project of a bunch of homely ingredients. I guess everybody likes a Hershey bar, but marshmallow? I mean, like what? I mean, I guess marshmallow treats are okay, the crispy things with the Rice Krispies. They're all right. They get stuck in your teeth. But it's sort of a homely thing, a marshmallow. And the graham cracker, I mean, I guess maybe I'm prejudiced against the graham cracker, but it's just kind of a gritty thing. But there's something when you combine the things together. It's really amazing. One thing that really struck me about the s'more is it's more than a sum of its parts. Because the graham cracker, the person who either invented or inspired the graham cracker in the early 19th century, Sylvester Graham, who was a rather joyless health advocate who inspired the graham flour. It's this really gritty, pasty flour that he made a cracker out of. He would have been absolutely appalled if he knew about the s'more. I think he would have sued. He would have been so upset because he actually, I'm trying to think of a way of framing this. He believed, I'll put it this way, he believed that if you ate a bunch of graham crackers, the original kind of sugarless one, it would diminish one's body urges.
Oh, my goodness.
So now you have these people eating these s'mores that are piled high with marshmallows and goopy, sugary Hershey's bars, and I think he would have just really freaked out.
Well, now I want a s'more right now. But we are talking about why we love camping, the appeal of camping, how America fell in love with camping, with our guest Dan White, who is the author of Under the Stars. And we welcome your questions, your experiences, your thoughts on camping. Do you love to go camping? What do you enjoy most about it? Do you have a favorite place to pitch a tent? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org, and maybe for better or worse we can talk about our most memorable camping trips. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Dan White, author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. How did you fall in love with camping? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones. Evan in Three Oaks is with us. Hello, Evan.
Hello.
Hi. So were you just camping, I understand?
Yeah, I was. I was up in the Keweenaw Peninsula of Michigan, up at the very tip, up by High Rock Bay. And what I really love about camping, we stopped at this little general store, and we were asking where the best place to camp was, and the little lady in there, she had a wonderful accent. She said, oh, well, you know, you just go down to the end of the road, it'll stop, but you just keep on going, and you'll find a spot. And so I don't know where we really ended up, but it was in the middle of a national forest at the end of a road. The Milky Way was absolutely spectacular, and to me, that's really the joy of camping. It's kind of like the spontaneity of it, and kind of not knowing what'll happen. So that's really what I love about it.
Oh, that sounds great, and the UP certainly is filled with wilderness. That's for sure, Evan. And so was that? Do I understand that was your first time camping?
Well, it wasn't my first time camping, and that's what. Wasn't my first time camping, but it almost felt like it was because it was so different from anything that I had done before. Because in the past, I had gone to the state park campgrounds where everybody has their 20-foot lot, their water and sewer and everything. And I mean, it's fun, but it's, I don't know. To me, I'm I'm trying to figure out if that's like really camping as opposed to like what I just finished doing.
Oh, so. good point. I'm glad you brought that up, Dan. That is, there are certainly different types of camping. So this is, Evan is just, just camping in a national forest, just in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness, as opposed to, I guess your neighborhood state park.
Yes, first of all, it's a wonderful story. The spontaneity aspect of it, I like that a lot, because instead of having to necessarily go to, even though national parks, of course, are just wonderful, the whole idea that that camping can be a little bit closer afield, and also just the idea of sort of someone just saying, yeah, pull over anywhere and you'll find a great spot. I've been thinking a lot about what constitutes real or fake camping, and I think the thing that amazed me is when I look back into the history of camping, there's the sort of anything goes attitude. I used to think, for instance, when I saw people camping with all these amenities from home, I thought, that's fake. That's just, what are they doing? Because I was raised to be more of a backcountry wilderness camping guy from my dad. We really valued that. But when I'm looking at the history of camping, some of the earliest campers in the recreational campers, 1850s and 1860s, they brought servants with them, they brought guides with them, they brought these gigantic tents with them. So it was this sort of bringing all your amenities from home kind of thing. So it may be less of an immediate experience than just going out there with very little, but what really is striking for me is I can't really call that inauthentic, because that kind of excessive camping or what you'd call glamour camping or glamping today, that existed even back then. People even back then were trying to bring everything away from home, and in some ways making it sort of recreating some of the comforts of home out there in the backcountry.
Yeah, so you don't have any problem with people who want to, I obviously teach their own, but that you consider glamping camping?
Here's the thing. I do consider it a form of camping. Do I necessarily love glamping? I mean, it feels a little weird for me, because I think one of the things, I guess it depends on what one wants to get out of the camping experience. What I like is the labor. I love setting up the tent. I love trying to figure out the best way of building the fire. It's almost like this reconfigured idea of labor and meaningful work. I like staying preoccupied. I even like this sort of low level of homeopathic stress in the campground, because what it does is it obliterates the stresses of home. It you're kind of replacing it. So if I go glamping, as I did for this book, and there's a gigantic tent that's set up for me, and there's running water, not flooding. It's usually what running water in my tent means, but just actually a shower in the tent. There's a toilet inside the tent that actually flushes, and doors with hinges. If someone's done all that work for me, I get fidgety after a while, because part of the recreation for me is that little bit of stress. It's warding off the bugs. It's the labor. It's cooking your own food. So, I'm the kind of camper who does get antsy when I do the really luxurious stuff. But I can't really call it inauthentic just because it's been around for so long.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if I've ever gone glamping quite like that. And in fact, when I considered whether I would try to go camping again, the part that discourages me is that part about the bugs and spiders crawling on me and ticks, but also as I'm older now, being on the ground, on the hard ground, is not as nice as that nice comfy bed. So thinking of a camper rather than a tent, what about that?
You're talking about an RV, like a tent trailer kind of thing. Once again, it's a vaunted camping tradition, because sometimes you'll see these great big parks, these big sprawling parks, where there'll be motorhomes and tents in the same place. And I used to be one of those guys. I used to be one of those wilderness campers who'd be in my little tent and say, look at that motorhome. They're not for real. What do they think they're doing? Why leave home if you're bringing your kitchen with you? But hey, you go back into the history of camping. Camping didn't really start taking off in America till really quite late in the 19th century, around the turn of the 20th century. And, lo and behold, the first motorhome, the first prototypical motorhome, came out in 1910. In 1910, this thing was unveiled in New York City, that the Pierce Arrow touring landau, which is almost as tricked out and luxurious as what you have today. So once again, in terms of American history and cultural history, the RV is a big part of camping. That's what's so strange and eccentric about American camping, is you have all these these extremes taking place at the same time, right around the time when Theodore Roosevelt was preaching about the strenuous life and doing it for yourself, and the Boy Scouts of America being founded, 1910 in America, Boy Scouts of America. That's the same year you started seeing mass-produced trailers, and that's the first motorhome. And it just kind of blows my mind that President Roosevelt and John Muir, who famously camped out in Yosemite in 1903, if they'd waited just a few years, they could have camped out in a motorhome. they could have just rolled down the street in one of these touring Landos. So all these impulses are taking place at the same time. The survivalist impulse, you know, going one way, and then the luxurious, bring everything you've got, bring a great big trailer, or bring a motorhome at the same time. So camping, it's always had these sort of forking tributaries. And it really takes all kinds, I think.
We are talking with Dan White, author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. And we want to know if you are in love with camping and what you love most about it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lori in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I would have to say in this state, my favorite place to camp is Newport State Park up in Ellison Bay. But out of state, Arches National Park in Moab, Utah, and White Sands in New Mexico on a full moon night with all that white sand is just beautiful. I've camped there twice. The only thing with that one is that White Sands Missile Range is south of there, and you can't reserve a site because you don't know when they're going to be blowing up missiles. I mean, it's like somebody just stomping on your sweet little mother's grave, because it's such a beautiful sight, and it's such a horrible thing to have that sort of thing happening over such a nice place.
But how inconvenient that is, yeah.
Yeah, and I find that as I get older, I'd rather camp instead of going to a motel, because in a motel you have the noisy people, you have bed bugs, you have all that you have to put up with other people, where camping, if you can just camp, hike in and not have to deal with other people, and it's quiet, and I would rather deal with dirt than filth. So
that's great. Thank you, Lori. She'd rather deal with dirt than filth. How's that, Dan?
That's great, the story, the two-part story, because first of all, I can completely relate to the idea of being in a pristine area and then boom, something scary happens and you kind of hit the floor. I was at Joshua Tree with my wife a few years ago, where we were hiking up and looking at some lizards and just admiring the foothills and the scenery, and suddenly these fighter jets just came just crashing through the sky. Oh. And it just threw me for a loop. But yeah, I completely understand the impulse of, you know, if campground versus motel, I would say the camping experience wins out every time. I think I agree about the dirt versus filth, which is an important distinction, but it's also a social element for me and for my family. I always feel like I'm in a hotel or a motel, like I'm kind of walled off from everybody. There's really no context for kind of meeting your neighbors, and I don't really remember any interactions I've had with other people at hotels or motels. It's just kind of a blur. But what's really interesting is when I think about campgrounds of America, I can think of my neighbors, and I can think of all the people I've spoken with over the years. I think part of that is the fact that my daughter and I instituted something called the Meet Your Neighbors Project, which I recommend for anyone car camping, by the way. You can create an instant community if you just kind of wander around and say, I'm trying to meet all my neighbors in the car camp. And it's incredible how many stories you can get, how first impressions often turn out to be wrong. Like my little girl and I will see some really tough-looking couple, and maybe they have scars, and they're kind of scowling by the campfire, and we'll go over and talk to them. They'll be completely disarmed, and they'll share their campfire stories. There was one time out in a car camp where we saw the scariest van I have ever seen. It had these big, bulging, psychedelic eyeballs on it. I thought, those people must be so scary. So we camped very far away from them. Let's keep away from these guys. The next day, we were wandering around, going towards the showers, and we run to them, this really sweet young couple from the Netherlands. They were just out seeing America in this crazy van. It turned out they ordered this thing, they reserved it online, and when they showed up to get their eyeball van, they were shocked. Wow, it's got eyeballs all over it. So these people who I visualize as these scary, villainous people, they're these nice people who are just, I was ready to sort of write them off because of their horrible-looking vehicle. And so I think that car camping can be really great if you allow a community to build. Of course, what I have to say about the noise thing is I've also seen the opposite aspect of it. Sometimes I've had car camping experiences go south because my neighbors have been monumentally noisy. And once again, with a Meet Your Neighbors project, if you, there's a group that's making tons of noise, and if you've got some previous interaction with them, you've met them with your kid, and then you waddle over there at 10 p.m. and say, could you please keep it down? They may respect that because there's some context. You're not just some scold shushing them. You've met them and humanized you a little bit. So
I wanted to ask you, Dan, because, like I said, it's been a long time since I've gone camping. And my husband and I, though, were at REI, the recreational equipment store.
Yeah, I love it.
And the... We bought a tent this weekend, a two-person tent, an REI special, and the guy said, this is great for car camping. And I said to myself, what exactly is car camping? So what exactly is car camping?
Well, first of all, the REI piece of it, I think one reason I'm so enraptured by that store is that you can go in there and kind of visualize the camping trips you'll have without ever leaving the store.
Right.
You can kind of live a whole camping trip in your mind. For me, car camping, the context has changed so much. But really, car camping basically is, I think of it as usually a planned campground. I mean, you could go over and pull over to the side of the road like the person who called in before. But when I think of car camping, what I usually visualize is a state or regional or national park where there are pullouts, where this big, long, kind of circular, looping parking lot where people are parked pretty close on, and you're usually parked by a river or a lake or in the middle of a forest. And it's just this empty spot. There's usually a reasonably flat, cleared, empty spot next to your car, and you go in there and you reserve and put a little flap on there saying, I've reserved this camping spot. And there's usually a guy, you know, driving around in a solar-powered golf cart with an American flag flapping on it, you know, making sure that you've paid up your fees. And it's this wonderful little intentional community if it goes well. What's interesting about car camping, it's got this really cushy connotation these days. There are a lot of survivalist type of campers, and this is also my younger self, who just rolled their eyes at the idea of car camping. And what's really interesting about that is the original issue car campers were called the auto campers. And this was, once again, this is the turn of the 20th century, and these people would car camp before there was any developed site, and they were risking their lives because cars were pretty bad then, didn't have reliable brakes. You'd go 10,000 feet up some mountain pass, and of course there's no guardrails, so people would plunge off cliffs all the time. They risked their lives for car camping, and people had to be able to understand basic bridge repair. Like if there's a crude bridge that kind of gave out, they had to know how to repair it. They had to winch their car out. They had to drag the car out through the mud. And there was no cell phones. There was no one there to rescue them. These people are out there doing these crazy things, driving into the wilderness with these crude cars. They would drive through rivers in their cars, drive through mudstorms with the cars. And so what blows me away is this whole idea of the original issue. Car campers were really hardened. They were elite, but kind of hardened survivalists. And just over the years, car camping has taken on this really cushy connotation. It's really changed and become more mainstream and comfortable.
Let's go to Robert in Green Bay next. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Joy. Love the show.
Thanks. And I understand that you're not a fan of car camping.
Well, not that I'm not a fan of car camping. My wife, my son, and I car camp all the time. We're actually going next week to Peninsula State Park up in Door County.
Oh, okay.
But I've always really liked backpacking, and I've done it off and on since I was a teenager. Last year, I went on about 10 trips, but I've always really liked backpacking. It's, you know, everything that I need is in my backpack. The pack weighs about 30 pounds. We hike anywhere from 10 to 12 miles a day. And pitch our tents and cook our food on a little gas stove, spend the night under the stars, and then, you know, walk out of the woods 3 or 4 days later.
Wonderful. And so you have to have a tinier tent then, Robert, for backpack camping?
Yep. Yeah, I have a, it's technically a two-person tent, but I'm kind of a bigger guy, so it's a one-person tent for me. And it weighs about 3.5 pounds. My sleeping bag weighs about 1.5 pounds. They're really... they're kind of high tech, so they pack down really tight, and you put them in compression bags, and it just it shrinks them down a little bit, so you can fit everything you need in your backpack.
And I'm sorry, I misstated your position. So it sounds like you like to do both, but the backpacking camping is maybe a little more of a challenge for you.
I do prefer that because it is more of a challenge. You know, I'm we're usually trying to set a destination every day, so it's a real struggle sometimes, depending on where we're camping. But it's the idea that you're just walking through the woods all day, and it's peaceful and it's quiet, and you're kind of alone with your thoughts. And then you get to your campsite at the night, and you set up your tent, you eat your food really quickly because you're usually pretty hungry, and it's, you know, you're usually in the middle of nowhere, so it's very quiet, it's serene, and it's you can kind of get back to your natural self.
So what kind of a meal do you make when you eat your meal for backpack camping?
For lunch, I'll have a packet of tuna fish and some peanut butter and some crackers, and for dinner, I have a dehydrator, so I try to make really high-calorie, really healthy, tasteful food, so I'll dehydrate like chicken Alfredo with some noodles and dehydrated vegetables, and or maybe some beef jerky to throw in there too, and then some hard cheese so that it can kind of handle not being refrigerated.
It sounds like you're eating well. So, Dan, comments on backpack camping as opposed to car camping?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, your caller is bringing back memories for me to tell you, because my father grew up in a city, and he grew up impoverished in this very urban environment, and he became a wilderness romantic because of it. I think it was reactionary. So everything we did that was camping, we were just out there in the woods. We were way out there in the wilderness. We took on a chunk of the John Muir Trail out in the High Sierra, 28 miles or so, and I was only 10 or 11 years old with a big old outer frame backpack. So I was really raised on that. It's interesting because usually people, families will take baby steps where the kids will go car camping and they'll later build up to the harder stuff. But I was doing the backpacking from the beginning. I had a book that came out a few years back called The Cactus Eaters. It's about these 2 years in which I took on the, I hiked the whole Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada. It goes through all of California, all of Oregon, all of Washington. And just as your caller was saying, there's something so elemental about that form of what I call lateral campground camping, where you are hiking 16 to 20 miles a day, every day, ducking out of the woods every once in a while to get supplies, usually hitchhiking, getting a box that was sent general delivery to the post office. Then you're back again. I was out in the wilderness for 11 to 12 days at a stretch, and sometimes you'd see nobody at all. And in some ways, I do think it's the most romantic and kind of elemental form of wilderness adventuring, because there's something that's just so primal about it and so basic. Even though there's an infrastructure there and you're being supported by people who are sending you these resupply boxes, the people that you meet, then looking at the map every once in a while and realizing that on your own power, with your own feet, you've walked across an entire state, it's really a powerful and life-changing experience if people have the time off to be able to take on a backpacking trail like the Pacific Crest Trail or the Continental Divide Trail or Appalachian Trail. It's really one of those things that you'll be thinking about for the rest of your life if you get a chance to do it.
Did you eat cactus when you're on that trail?
I did eat a cactus. It's funny because sometimes people look at the title of the book, The Cactus Eaters, and think it's like this sort of transformative, sort of new agey Carlos Castaneda kind of thing.
No.
But it refers to an episode in which I just left Tehachapi, and I was with my then girlfriend at the time, and I was just really dehydrated, and I had been walking in the hot sun, and there was supposed to be a spring, but we just weren't reaching the spring, and I saw this really beautiful, juicy-looking cactus, and I was in a pretty brain-addled state just from dehydration, and what I didn't see is really how protected with spines this thing was, and I thought if I chewed on that cactus, I could get all this water out of it, because I'd heard they were full of water. So I just whipped out my Swiss Army knife and cut off a big lobe of the cactus, the prickly pear, and I stuck that right in my mouth, and I started chewing on it. So that did not turn out the way that I thought it would be. There was really something. I can still, just telling it to you, I'm feeling kind of dry mouth. I could feel those little things, the little stingers in my mouth. So
I bet, yeah. I did not do any backpacking on the Appalachian Trail in May, but I did walk a section. I did a day hike with my husband and his sister and brother-in-law, and it was really great just to do that. But what struck me is that maybe when you were walking the Pacific Crest Trail, you didn't see people. We saw people everywhere. It was really apparently really popular. I mean, it was people who were doing the whole thing. I was amazed. They were going to go from Georgia to Maine and camp along the way. It was going to take them months.
Yeah, everything is kind of changing. I think as gear gets lighter and lighter, and as people embrace this sort of featherweight gear ethos, and food gets lighter and people bring less and less, and also just the popularity of camping, and you see bumps with various books like Wild by Cheryl Strayed, the kind of a flock to the Pacific Crest Trail. What always amazes me is if I'm out in some very rugged terrain and I'm really far from everything, and then you see a big crowd. That was true when I did the John Muir Trail section of the PCT. It's not a section of the PCT, but the John Muir Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail share the same pathway for a couple hundred miles. And so you do see crowds and crowds of people, and I've heard that's really true for the Appalachian Trail, where these travelers go to these go to the lean-tos. You don't necessarily have to bring a tent because they have these cabin-like structures there. And you'll get there, and it'll be fully booked, and people will just be sleeping like sardines, just all packed in there. First come, first served. So it's wonderful to see how popular camping has become. I read this one article, this one essay, saying that camping is in decline and people aren't doing it anymore. And I think to myself, really? And I can't get a space out there. But on the other hand, when I see the massive popularity of camping, what it reminds me of is we have to change the way that we interact with each other and the way we interact with the wilderness when there are so many people out there. So it's almost come full circle. You have these advocates like Henry David Thoreau all those years ago saying, let's preserve the woods, that every state should have its reserved parks. And now you have a situation in which it's so mainstreamed and so popular that we could almost kill it with by loving it to death. So that's where Leave No Trace comes in, of course.
We are talking about our love of camping and how this came to be and why 50 million Americans or so now participate in camping every year, talking about the different types of camping, glamping and car camping and backpacking camping. And we're wondering what kind of camping you love, or maybe you need a pep talk to try camping. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you have a memorable camping trip that you would like to share? We'd love to hear your experiences, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about camping as many Americans are celebrating the long 4th of July weekend by pitching a tent at their favorite campground. Talking about camping with Dan White. He's author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. He's a travel writer as well as the contributing editor of the Catamaran Literary Reader. And as we just heard, he's also the author of The Cactus Eaters, which is about his hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail. Well, we have full lines, so back to the phones we go. And Wayne in Rockland is with us. Hi, Wayne.
Hi.
Yes,
yeah,
go ahead.
Our camping experience, we started off in a tent, and then we progressed up to a little pop-up camper, and now we drive a 33-foot travel trailer. But the best thing about our camping experience is that we take all of our grandchildren, leave all the parents home, so it's me and grandma and eight kids out there, and we get to spoil them all weekend long without mom saying, oh, they can't have a candy bar, or they can only have one more. None of their electronics work because you don't want to plug them in, so they all go dead in the first day we're there. So it's just me and Grandma and all the kids, and we just have a blast out in the woods or wherever we can find a place to put the camper.
I love that. I just do. Dan, you know, and this is a grandpa who, you know, now has a big RV, it sounds like, and gets to fit all the grandkids in there, too.
I love that story. That was great. You know what really grabbed me is that, yeah, there's the great big camper. Enough to fit everybody and some amenities from home. But here's the thing. He also talked about being offline.
Yep.
You can't constantly check the Facebook status updates. You can't check the scary, you know, news every day. And I think that is really elemental. That's how you can have an authentic, restorative camping trip. It doesn't really matter what you bring. I really like the idea of being away, of being cut off from everything for a little while. This was not a motorhome camping trip for me, but I went up to the Ho Rainforest that's up in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State with my wife and my child. And we were only about a mile and a half from the visitor center, but we were out there, And the Hoh Rainforest on this bank, the sort of a sand bank with cobbles there, and the rushing Hoh River swirling past us, and there were river otters playing, and the fiery crown of Mount Olympus rising over the campsite. But what's really great about it is we were absolutely unreachable. My cell phone not only didn't get texts and didn't get calls, but it was so out of whack that even the timekeeping function didn't work. It kept saying that it was May of 1980.
Oh, my goodness. That's so, kind of eerie, isn't it?
It's kind of eerie, but I just love the idea that there's all these sort of swirling messages and updates and frightening things and busyness and scheduling that couldn't reach us. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I love about camping is the sort of disabled cell phone. Of course, the sort of sad, challenging thing now is that we have especially young people who are so tech savvy that you could go out there in the middle of nowhere and be a national forest, national park, and there are young people who know how to create a Wi-Fi hotspot with a Pringle container. You can turn an empty container of Pringles into a Wi-Fi hotspot if you know how to rig it. You have these people who can make these hacks that can make every forest wired. So I think in the future it'll have to be more of a willful choice to cut ourselves off from this kind of technology. But I think that if one wants to get the full benefit of a restorative camping experience, like the fellow who just called in, I think it's great to see if we can unplug for a little bit. I think that's part of the benefit.
I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about the popularity of camping and whether it's on the increase or decrease. With kids, we hear about the nature deficit disorder and kids who are glued to their screens all the time. I mean, do we know if young people today are loving camping as much as we did when we were kids?
I'd heard informally that there's more of a resurgence in interest in camping from young people. I'd read Richard Louv's book, Last Child in the Woods, about the wired generation, and I do feel like it gets kind of scary when people are just using these sort of thumb-twiddling devices all day long. But I feel like there's more outreach programs these days, more programs teaching ecology. There are a lot of these sort of hands-on, immersive ecological science programs in which kids are going out there and getting their hands dirty. But I think the main thing is to really get kids started really young, to make it really second nature for them to go camping and do it incrementally. I was camping with my kid when she was 3 or 4 years old, and she was scared at first, but we did gradual baby steps. And by the end of it, by the time she was 4, we were backpacking, and she was loving it. Just teaching them that wilderness is fun, that it's not scary or dangerous, and just that, it's sort of a gradual wilderness indoctrination is what I call it.
Yes, Sue on Facebook says, I have camped for almost 50 years. I raised 4 children many years as a single parent. For me, it was an awesome way to entertain and teach the children about nature. For me, it was a wonderful way to get a break from the daily routine. For a family on a limited budget, such as myself and many other families, camping is an affordable way for everyone to bond together. Well, that's a good point, too. It usually doesn't have to cost very much, does it?
It doesn't have to cost very much. And the great thing about it is that different things become a source of entertainment because you're working with what you have. It's incredible how entertaining the whole process of the campfire can be. The whole drama of it is, will Daddy be able to figure out how to light the campfire at all? And gathering around it and warming yourself, and when are we going to have the s'mores? It replaces the TV set, and you can wring hours and hours of enjoyment and drama just from the campfire. And I also like the fact that when we camp and we're cut off from certain amenities from home, it forces us to be really creative. Aside from going out there and meeting all the neighbors when you're car camping, I love to do scavenger hunts with my kid, where there are certain things that I'll study up in advance. I'll Google it and look up certain aspects of this national park or forest. And often if you go to a national park, there are these wonderful ranger packets where the rangers there will give these kids these little packets of things, these checklists of things to find, and the kids will get a little junior ranger badge if they get all the answers correct. And the other thing that I think is great for kids in terms of entertainment is just really implicating, involving them in the camp. You really need to give them a task. Help them unroll the tarp or have them help you set the tent up or stake the tent down. If a kid feels invested in the trip, if a kid has a job, that child will enjoy it so much more than if they're just sort of idling on the sidelines and watching you do everything.
Jeff in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. I grew up camping, and my parents would take us out kind of wilderness camping, and we'd have to pound stakes into the ground and blow up the air mattresses. And it was always great escape to go into the woods and spend time together. But I had to tell you, I really hated it. And I always wished we could be a normal family that would have a camper. So now my idea of camping is going to a five-star hotel and have fine dining. I'm not camping at all, although my brother and his wife and their kids go camping into the wilderness. My niece is somewhere hiking in New Mexico this weekend. And my sister and her family have nothing to do with camping. So it's interesting.
Yeah, well, it is. I'm glad you called, Jeff, because it's not everyone's cup of tea, Dan. And you said you kind of have a love-hate relationship with camping, too.
I really do. And you know what? I would never judge people for hating camping, for steering away from it, because I sometimes wrestle with myself. I think sometimes it's a question of how you look back on the camping trip. I just find that sometimes a camping trip where I'm out there almost wishing I'm in a motel or in a camper, and I'll get, there'll be bugs. And I remember in the wilderness with my dad, I'd have weird food, freeze-dried three-color ice cream, you know, crunchy ice cream and crunchy, crispy freeze-dried meatballs and all kinds of weird stuff. And then you'd be out there, it would be steep and it would be cold. The thing that is strange for me is I would then leave the forest and I'd want to be back there again. So I would find very often that camping trips, even the ones that are unpleasant for me, often improve through the act of retrospection or the act of storytelling. I think a lot of people who love camping have kind of come to terms with the fact that even if it goes south out there, even if it's pretty chaotic and if it's buggy or muddy, you can redeem something through the act of remembering it, through the act of telling the story to your friends, to your family, to strangers. And often the more disastrous the camping trip is, the more fun it is to recount it later on for some reason. So I do feel like when I was in the Adirondacks, I had this whole adventure out in the Adirondacks where I was exploring the roots, the history of camping and the guided camping system. And I was at a bar there, and a couple of people were telling me about the two funds of camping. The first fun is the fun that you may or may not be having in the present day when you're camping. And the second fun is remembering it. It's the fun you have in recollecting your campfire stories and recollecting the stories that you share about your camping trips, good and bad. So for me, at least, it's something that tends to improve over time when I'm looking back on it.
Gary on Facebook says, if you're going to sleep out under the stars, you might want to take along a star chart, which depicts the night sky for any time of the year. And he included a link to a star chart that he uses. Do you have any other, and we only have about a minute or so to go, do you have any other tips for people who might be novices to camping?
I really feel that my main tip is there's really no rules. If you're thinking about authenticity, just keep in mind that the American camping tradition includes all sorts. It includes the trailer, includes stomping through the wilderness, includes glamping, all these things. I mean, if you're going out there and you're in a little state park close to home and you want to bail out halfway because it's not working out, that's fine. If you want to bail out, have a pizza, that's fine. I think that the people shouldn't impose too many rules on themselves when they're first camping. I think that it's all about having a good time, disconnecting from your telecommunications devices, having family togetherness, having memorable times. So there's no real right or wrong as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm going to close. Judy emails, I love camping because there's no perfume more beautiful than a pine tree. There's nothing more serene than sitting by a campfire at night under the stars. I love listening to owls calling at night when I'm in my camper bed, or hearing loons fly overhead with their distinct call. I love waking up under the trees and just being out there.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Dan White is the author of Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. Thanks to producer Chris Molina and Brianne Shasso. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Pitch our tent in a beautiful spot. Dad says it's hard, but I know that it's not. Couple of poles, couple of strings. Yes, there's a couple of other funny things. I can't.